This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Heretic Spellblade 2, Book 2 of Heretic Spellblade, written by K.D. Robertson, performed by Stephanie Savannah. Chapter 1. A vast hellscape lay before Nathan. It split into two separate valleys only a stone's throw from where he stood. The sky glowed a hazy red, and purple light shined from within the many cracks that stretched across the volcanic wasteland. Other than Nathan, only two other people were present, both women. The three of them stood on a wooden palisade at the far end of the valley. Behind them, a solid stone wall rose into the clouds. A double-door gate was the only visible exit from this strange world, and it remained closed for now.
"It wasn't like this when I patrolled last night," one of the women said.
Her name was Sen, and she hid her lithe, toned frame beneath a red cloak. Her brown hair held streaks of white, but her vivid red eyes were what drew most people's attention.
"So it split into two overnight," Nathan said.
Sen winced and looked away.
"When you put it that way."
"That's not what I meant," Nathan said. "We're standing in a demonic portal. Anybody who says they understand how these worlds work is lying. They can change in an instant. This portal has been growing since we repelled the invasion in summer. Now the valley has split. That's important."
Demonic portals dotted the world of Domar. They were a fact of life, and so were the demonic invasions they regularly caused. Nathan was a bastion. That meant his job was to keep the portals under control. Both women here were his champions, powerful warriors empowered with his magic that served him and helped him defeat the demons. As far as most people were concerned, bastions like Nathan knew everything about the portals and how to stop the demons. Reality was a touch more complicated.
"I don't remember being taught anything about portals changing shape," the other woman said.
She was Yphela, better known as Fae. A bushy black cat's tail swished back and forth behind her, and a pair of cat ears twitched on her head. She wore the black and silver uniform of a champion of the Onfang Empire, including a gleaming black breastplate. In Fae's case, her breastplate lived up to its name. No amount of steel plate could hide her massive chest. Her figure was the opposite of Sen's in many ways, with curves where Sen was lithe.
"Nobody taught you anything because portals usually don't change shape," Nathan said. That was the problem.
The world of a demonic portal was normally composed of two sections, the valley and the clearing. The clearing was a large open space where the rift to the demonic dimension opened during an invasion. The valley was the long descent to that clearing, with the exit to the world of Domar at the other end. Steep cliffs lined the sides of the world, preventing escape through any other means. In the simplest terms, Nathan's job was to stop the demons from getting from one end to the other. Months ago, he had done exactly that and stopped a demonic invasion. The wall he stood on was a remnant of that defense. But now the portal had changed into a different shape. It had two valleys, each of which joined connected to the clearing and the exit to the Domar. On the face of it, nothing had changed. The valleys came together far enough from the exit that Nathan could still defend a single location if he chose to. But the fact that there were two valleys was disquieting.
"You haven't seen this before, have you?"
Sen asked quietly, trying to prevent Fae from hearing. From the way Fae's ears pricked up, it was a futile effort. Fae was a cat beastkin and had excellent hearing among her other enhanced physical traits.
"I haven't," Nathan admitted, running a hand through his unkempt black hair. He hadn't cleaned up properly this morning, as Fae had dragged him out of bed in a rush after her morning patrol.
The admission that he didn't know what was happening was more significant than it sounded.
Most bastions oversaw only one or two portals, and never saw anything significant in their lives. Furthermore, Nathan had only officially become a bastion less than a year ago. His real-world experience was low. On paper. Because Nathan was arguably one of the most experienced bastions on Domar right now. He had seen the collapse of nearly every nation on the continent, battled demons across almost every climate and in every situation. He had fought and defeated monsters who had slain legendary bastions and champions. Then Nathan had been defeated himself, only to be given the chance to go back in time and prevent the destruction of Domar. He had seen a timeline that nobody else knew about. That also meant he knew a lot more than he technically should. Sen knew the truth about Nathan's past. Her personality had been carried over from Nathan's timeline. But Faye didn't know the truth, hence why Sen tried to exclude the Beastkin from the conversation. Faye continued to lean against the wooden spikes of the palisade. Her eyes were fixed on some point in the distance, but she remained alert. Sen glared at her fellow champion. It became evident that Faye wasn't going anywhere. "This is bad," Nathan admitted, giving up on the idea of keeping Faye out of the loop. She was his champion as well, so it didn't hurt for her to know what was coming.
"How bad?" Sen asked.
"I think a messenger is coming."
"What?"
Sen blurted out. "What's a messenger?" Faye asked, turning her head toward the two of them. Pretending that they both asked the same question, Nathan explained,
"Messengers are demonic generals. They are tremendously powerful and control magic that is only partially understood. Where we use magic that uses the natural elements such as fire and wind, they can manipulate space, time, and even the currents of magic."
"Time?" Faye mumbled. She shook her head and asked, "How come I haven't learned anything about this? The Academy taught me about different types of demons, but I never learned about their generals."
Sen remained silent. She already knew about messengers, after all. "Because the idea of demons as powerful as bastions terrifies people," Nathan said. "More powerful, even. They're the stuff of myth and legend. The worst of them are monsters capable of defeating Tri-Gem champions or destroying entire countries. At least one appeared when the Kurai Peninsula fell. By all accounts, they have the same power over demonic portals that bastions have over binding stones." Or at least, that's what Nathan had believed. Recent occurrences made him doubt that wisdom.
"That's why nobody talks about Kurai," Sen muttered.
"Pretty much. It's easier to pretend that Kurai was corrupt and incompetent than admit that something more powerful invaded them than we're prepared for," Nathan said. He looked out at the wasteland around him. The split valleys brought back memories he preferred not to dwell on. Memories of the last time he saw a demonic portal do things he had never seen before. His life had been turned upside down on that night. A messenger had emerged from a portal and destroyed his life's work, killed everybody he loved, and brought him back here. Nathan wasn't about to let history repeat itself. This new messenger wasn't going to defeat him. The three of them left the portal, exiting through the gate in the stone wall behind them. They found themselves in the Great Hall of Garrick Pass, Nathan's main fortress. Gray limestone walls surrounded them, broken up by gleaming statues, vivid rugs, and elaborate tapestries. The keep was lavishly decorated, and the upper level of the hall contained enough precious metals in its decorations to buy a whole other keep. Snow piled up against the windows, and ice coated the exterior of the glass. Not all the statues were inanimate, however. Beside the gate he had walked through were two imposing knights that turned to face him. Each stood nearly 3 meters tall and wielded halberds the size of a draft horse. There was nothing but air inside their armor, but the knights moved and glared at Nathan regardless.
A moment later, they decided that he, Faye, and Sen weren't a threat, and became still once again. These knights were some of Nathan's summons. He animated them using his magical power as a bastion, and they served as some of his most powerful warriors. Their armor was over an inch thick and imbued with magic. Even demons would struggle to harm them, and a single return blow could cleave through a dozen monsters in return. It was this same power that let Nathan decorate Garrick Pass with so much wealth. He could create whatever metals he wanted using magic, although he had to be careful about selling too much of his fake gold and other creations. Nathan also used this power to keep his finances afloat, as did most bastions. Nasty letters tended to flow from nobles if a bastion crashed the precious metal market by selling too much, however. Nathan even knew of one bastion in his timeline that was executed for selling reproductions of extremely rare artwork. Only a couple of people wandered around the hall at this early hour. The lamps were still on, lit by magic, and no light streamed in through the windows. One of those present was a young wolf girl who saluted Nathan from a distance, her tail wagging violently. She wore the uniform of Faye's knights, and she was one of the beastkin he was training to be an elite warrior. He saluted back. Moments later, the wolf girl's eyes widened, and she turned away to resume her patrol. Nathan spotted Faye making shooing motions and gave her a look. "She can flirt with you when I think she's good enough," Faye said with a pout.
"Since when has a salute counted as flirting?" Nathan asked.
"Since she wagged her tail like a dog about to receive a treat."
Nathan left out the fact that the wolf girl was a dog, in a way. Beastkin weren't just humans with animal ears and tails, but also shared animalistic traits. Wolf beastkin were highly social animals and showed their emotions as openly as actual dogs. Besides, Faye wasn't much better. Nathan ruffled her hair, and her tail wagged back and forth in response. A moment later, she squawked and jumped away. Her eyes darted around the hall, looking for anybody watching them. She relaxed once she confirmed that nobody had seen them. Sen rolled her eyes at their antics.
"So, what are we doing about this messenger?"
"For one thing, we're not talking about it in the open." Nathan glared at Sen, who winced. "Otherwise, we have time to build up our response. It's winter, so we don't need to worry about war with the Federation. That means I can focus all my power on reinforcing the portal."
"Are we sure the Federation won't attack during winter? It's not that far from their borders, and we can't easily cross the Garrick Mountains," Sen said.
This was Nathan's other responsibility as Bastion. With the power at his disposal, he didn't merely fight off demons. He fought other nations. Until last summer, this fortress had marked the eastern border of the Anfeng Empire, which Nathan served. The Garrick Mountains separated the Anfeng Empire from the Amica Federation, and Garrick Pass was the southernmost land route through the mountains. While the Empire had been distracted, the Federation had invaded. Nathan fought them off and counterattacked. The result had been that he seized a significant portion of Federation territory on the eastern side of the mountain range. Part of that had included Fort Tobram, a Federation fortress. "The pass may be snowed in, but the Federation suspects that we have a way to cross anyway. We proved that when they attacked Vera's Tower," Nathan said. "Besides, winter is hell on logistics at the best of times. There's no food to forage, no crops being grown that armies can pillage, and many villages will be running lean over winter. That means you need to supply everything yourself when attacking." Nathan continued, "Even if the Federation is willing to do that, winter is still awful. Snow makes travel slower, wagons get stuck, animals become vulnerable to freezing weather, and a caravan of draft animals can be worth more than the supplies. And if it rains, everything grinds to a halt."
"So they'd be stupid to attack," Sen said.
"Nobody starts a campaign in winter. Even continuing one over winter is difficult. We're learning that up north."
Nathan shook his head.
The Empire was bogged down in a war with its northern neighbor, Trefome, which had carried on into winter.
So we're spending the next couple of months preparing for the demons?
Fay asked. No, we're preparing for both war with the Federation and a demonic invasion, Nathan corrected. Once winter ends, we need to be ready for both. But right now, we can focus everything on the demons, which means I can use the reserves in my binding stones.
Both women nodded at Nathan. The sapphire implanted in Faye's collarbone glimmered in the light of the hall. Nathan was a bastion, and the heart of a bastion's power was their binding stone, or stones, in Nathan's case. He had captured a second when he had counterattacked the Federation. Reaching into his mind, Nathan found a monolithic entity lurking in the back of it. When he got close to it, it expanded out into a complex web of magical connections. Two nodes of magic stood out from the rest, and tethers linked them together in Nathan's mental world. Compared to Nathan's magical presence, each of these nodes eclipsed him by several orders of magnitude. These were binding stones, and each possessed magical power capable of altering reality. A glowing orb of stone hovered in the basement of Garrick Pass and represented the physical presence of the binding stone. But Nathan had bound the binding stone to his mind and could access its power at any time and from any place. The catch was that the farther away from a binding stone he was, the weaker the power became. Nobody knew how the binding stones had been created or what they did, but Nathan had been trained to control them using techniques passed down from bastions over millennia. Supposedly, the Watcher Omria, the goddess of the world, had taught the first bastions how to claim and use the binding stones. Nathan tapped into his binding stones and confirmed that they had a substantial reserve. Neither was close to full yet, but he hadn't used either one for some time. Both of his fortresses had magical generators that powered them, and those ran directly off the ley lines rather than the binding stones. Although Nathan used the binding stones as a backup, should the ley lines ever become unstable. Technically, the ley lines connected to the binding stones, but the power drain was minuscule. Every time Nathan cast a spell using the binding stone, he used enough energy to power the keep for a year. Altering the fabric of reality was horrendously inefficient. Returning to the real world, Nathan saw that no time had passed. While he was in his mental world, the binding stone slowed the passage of time. It often enabled him to strategize or think through plans that otherwise required more time than he had. "I'll use the binding stones to upgrade the defenses of the portal," Nathan said. "Although I don't know if we'll only defend the gate or each valley separately. Splitting our forces may be dangerous, but it's possible that allowing the enemy to combine their strength may be more dangerous." Although he wasn't admitting it to the girls, Nathan knew a little more about the threat than he let on. There was somebody he needed to meet with to confirm his theory with, however. Sen nodded, although she gave him a suspicious look.
"I'll contact Fort Tabram and have them check if anything is wrong with their portal. Fay, I'll increase the intensity of the training for the night,"
Fay chirped, pointedly ignoring Sen.
"Maybe I can get some new recruits, too. You can make more enchanted weapons if we find more knight candidates, right?"
Nathan raised an eyebrow. "I won't say no to more qualified knights, but fighting demons is difficult. Any beastkin who isn't strong enough to handle it will die. There's a reason I've kept the numbers small."
"I have a different question," Sen said, once she realized Fay was ignoring her. "This is happening a lot faster than I expected. We've been here for less than a year. Why so quickly? Why here?"
Sen surely knew at least part of the answer to that. But to Nathan, it was Fay's reaction that interested him the most. No surprise appeared on her face. Instead, she glanced between Nathan and Sen with a look of faint curiosity, as if wondering if she would hear an answer at all.
"Leopold did tell us that suppressing the last invasion so easily would have consequences," Nathan said. and that invasion wasn't brought about by natural means in the first place. Things are awry.
Awry didn't even begin to cover it. Nathan had to visit a special somebody to gain some answers. Sen and Faye might not be happy with his explanation, but it would suffice. After all, Nathan was about to battle a messenger he knew nothing about. His knowledge of his original timeline couldn't help him, and he had far fewer resources and champions than when he had fought messengers in his own timeline.
Chapter 2. At the back of Nathan's office was a pitch-black door. He didn't know what it was made of or how it was built. He didn't even know how it had appeared there. What he did know was that it didn't reside on this plane of existence. Nobody other than him could see it, and everybody else saw and felt a solid wall in its place. If he drove a nail into the wall, dust puffed out from midair. His binding stone told him that the door wasn't even there. He pushed the door open and stepped into the white void that appeared beyond it. When the blinding light faded from his eyes, he found himself in a strange black space. A room and furniture were marked out around him in white outlines, but almost none of it held color or substance. Nathan felt as though he had stepped into a picture book that somebody had barely started drawing. A bed, a table, and a pair of chairs were the only items that appeared real to Nathan's eyes. They had color and texture. There was also a scantily clad woman reading a book on top of the bed, but Nathan pretended not to notice her. She dropped her book and focused her attention on him. The room had changed in the week since he had last been here. He felt a chill as he realized that the shift in the portal was likely related to the change here. For the past year, he had been denying the slow changes to this void room. What happened in here didn't affect him, and the introduction of color made his increasingly regular visits less unsettling. So wasn't that good? But he couldn't help but think that every change that occurred here related to either the demonic portals or the binding stones. When he had last been here, this place had appeared to be a large bedroom with an attached bathroom. But now it had countertops and strange objects lining one wall. It was hard for him to tell, given they were only outlines, but they reminded him of the magical appliances in modern kitchens. The kettles and stovetops were normally powered using enchantments.
"You like my new kitchen, I take it?" the woman asked.
Curiosity overwhelmed Nathan's desire to annoy her, and he answered her,
"So it is a kitchen."
"What else would it be?"
"I don't know. I looked in your bathroom the other week and genuinely wondered whether I had fallen into another dimension," Nathan said.
"Yes, well, I find the technology of your world a little quaint," she said. "And by quaint, I mean that it's frankly bizarre. The anachronisms hurt my modern sensibilities."
Nathan rubbed the bridge of his nose. As with many conversations he had with her, they became confusing quickly. This delightful woman was Kadria. The four curly horns rising from her skull gave away her inhumanity. She was a messenger. The same messenger who had defeated him in his timeline and given him a second chance. He still didn't know what her angle was. He especially didn't know why she insisted on wearing so little clothing. The black cloth covering her chest and bottom barely qualified as underwear, and the only other things she wore were a number of platinum hoops and bangles on her thighs, hips, and arms. Her black hair had grown out since he first met her, and she now tied it back in a short ponytail. What hadn't changed was her bronzed skin, and the sheer amount of it she showed, along with her lithe figure, always drew his eye. Kadria smirked at him and ran a finger along a bare thigh.
"My, you haven't even had breakfast yet, and you're already looking for an excuse to exercise?"
He glared at her. "That's not why I'm here."
"I figured. You usually visit in the afternoon,
when your champions are all too busy to keep you company, Kadria said. Normally you have one at night, one in the morning, and can often squeeze some time in over lunch. But when they all wander off to their duties, you feel lonely and want some female companionship.
By your explanation, I sleep with 3 women a day, so I don't think I need any more female companionship, Nathan said dryly.
Oh, but I give you something they don't. Kadria moved her hand in front of her mouth in an obscene motion, and Nathan's body reacted despite himself. She giggled, her eyes drawing lower on his body. He sighed and tried to ignore her provocations. It was too early in the morning to waste his stamina on her. Pulling up a seat, he plopped himself down at the table. She pouted in response, but scrambled off the bed and into the opposite chair. A pair of mugs appeared on top of it, along with a thick slice of cake. Naturally, only Kadria ate cake.
You usually share the sweets, Nathan said.
You'll spoil your breakfast. I know you haven't eaten yet, she replied. He idly wondered how she knew what he was always up to.
The mugs filled with coffee from the bottom up. The brew had a strong smell to it, and was unlike anything he had ever drunk outside this room. Kadria had absolute power over this space, and could create food and drink at will. Nathan lacked that power, as did any bastion.
This is normal coffee, isn't it? He asked.
Have I ever given you anything strange? She replied, batting her eyes at him innocently.
I'm pretty sure you gave me coffee with horseradish in it last week.
Wasabi, actually.
The green plant from the Kurai Peninsula? Nathan asked, surprised to hear the name.
Oh, you call it the same thing here?
Kadria looked surprised. She muttered under her breath,
or maybe it's a translation thing.
I can't imagine why you would add that to coffee, Nathan said.
Because seeing your face was funny? Kadria giggled. Even the memory makes me laugh. But no, this is normal coffee. Just, you know, better than what you drink.
The two of them drank in silence for close to a minute. Nathan dwelled on the mysteries of the demon opposite him. He didn't know what thoughts ran through Kadria's head. No, that was a lie. He had some idea, given her foot was crawling up his leg.
The portal has split into 2 valleys, Nathan said eventually.
I suppose the twins are getting ready to invade, Kadria responded idly.
So they are behind this.
I already told you to be ready for them, Kadria said. And who else could modify the structure of a portal so drastically? I doubt this will be a full-fledged incursion. They're fairly powerful messengers, and this world isn't ready to summon 2 at once. But they seem rather impatient.
Why are they showing their hands so readily? Nathan asked. Most messengers wait until the last moments before they attempt to invade. You gave me less than 24 hours to react.
Because they're not here to ransack and pillage the world. They're here to play.
Kadria pointed a finger at him.
Play with you, to be specific. You were an idiot when you stopped the last invasion and caught their eye. Now they want to take you out on a date, see a movie, maybe steal a kiss.
I have no idea what you're saying, Nathan said.
What the hell was a movie? Kadria rolled her eyes.
They're going to have some fun with you, blow things up, and see if you're interesting enough to keep pursuing. I told you before that each messenger has their own objective. They're not the take-over-the-world type, more the collect-their-playmates type, I think.
You think? Nathan asked.
I mean, I only talk to them. I don't live in their head. If I'm wrong and they try to blow your head off instead of blowing another part of your body, don't blame me.
Kadria grinned lewdly.
Nathan settled down as her words sank in. His coffee had cooled down, but it tasted great all the same. Eventually, he said, "That makes them sound a lot less dangerous than I expected, which improves my confidence." "Oh, that's not the reaction you should have. They're still plenty dangerous," Kadria said, eyes wide. "You just told me that they're not here to blow my head off, probably." "Sure, but that doesn't mean they're not going to blow other heads off. You have a bunch of champions whose heads I suspect you'd prefer to be attached to their bodies, unless you have an interest in things that are a little too much, even for me." Kadria raised an eyebrow. "You don't, do you?" "No." He glared at her. "Good. Also, we have something of a working partnership going here. We're trying to prevent this world from turning into a wasteland overrun by demons. It's rather hard for me to help you accomplish that if another messenger turns you into their plaything. So try not to lose," Kadria added. "And there's the catch," Nathan muttered. "You're not going to help me deal with them at all, are you?" "In battle? Absolutely not. If our relationship is uncovered, everything will fall apart." Kadria grimaced. "But I can tell you that you don't want to fight them together, and that I'm doubtful they'll attack anytime soon." "Don't fight them together." Nathan noted that mentally. He would need to erect defenses in each valley then. Presumably, something bad would happen if the twins both reached the far end. Then he blinked, taking in Kadria's final comment. "Why not?" he asked. "The sooner they attack, the less prepared I am." "Because, as I said earlier, this world isn't ready for two messengers yet. By all rights, they shouldn't even be able to appear. It's odd that they're able to make a visible appearance." Kadria bit her lip. Something clicked in Nathan's mind. "This has to do with the war, doesn't it?" "I had hoped that by bringing you here, I would push this world onto a new path, one free from interference. But that doesn't seem to have happened." "Not yet." Kadria sighed. "Your world collapsed under similar circumstances. A messenger broke in during a war between the Federation and the Empire and ruined everything. It happens a lot." "This is about those predetermined events you mentioned. I don't really believe in the idea that the future is predictable," Nathan said. Kadria smiled faintly. "Luckily for you, it's not. At least, not fully." "You can control time," Nathan said incredulously. "How can any future be predetermined if that's possible?"
"Let's just say that your understanding of time and the way it works in practice are very far apart. Trust me, because I'm the interdimensional invader whose entire existence relies on knowing how this works," Kadria said.
"That doesn't inspire much trust."
"Hush, you," Kadria said.
Then she smirked.
"In any case, you shouldn't be so worried about this situation. Being at war with the Federation is good for you, isn't it? After all, isn't there a certain someone that you desperately want to join you?"
Chapter 3. Narime. The meeting room filled up suspiciously quickly. Narime raised an eyebrow and looked at the champion standing beside her. Most shrugged in response, but Lucia ignored her. The young champion seemed nervous and kept glancing around. Her black pigtails flicked about with each of her movements. Lucia's presence was strange in and of itself. Normally, her place in this meeting would be taken by a different champion by the name of Seraph. With no answers forthcoming, Narime contented herself to wait. She was a mystic fox and had a few centuries under her belt. waiting a few minutes, or even a few hours, to find out the answer to this particular mystery was nothing new. She drew her 6 silver tails close to her body and made herself as comfortable as possible. Her dress today was a simple dark blue one with long thigh slits, and it hugged her busty figure closely. A pair of sapphires resided in her collarbone, but she had covered them with a piece of black cloth wrapped around her neck. Her silver fox ears twitched as she glanced around her. The meeting room was massive, ornate, and ostentatious. A 12 oaken chairs surrounded a table large enough that an entire marching band could walk down it. Each chair was plated in solid gold, and the table itself was rimmed in platinum. Various crystalline statues of the goddess Omria lined the center of the table. Chandeliers hung from the vaulted ceiling. Outside, past the floor-to-ceiling glass windows, was a rock garden in the style of Narime's homeland. She knew them as Zen Gardens. Narime doubted that the owner of this mansion had any idea of the origins of Zen Gardens. No doubt he had liked the appearance of one and spent an obscene amount of money replicating it. Although, given Narime's homeland no longer existed, she wasn't going to complain too loudly. Reminders of her homeland were few and far between these days. Eventually, 11 of the 12 seats filled up, and the occupant of the 12th seat dialed in using the wireless device that sat in the very center of the table. Narime knew that something was very wrong. She couldn't remember the last time she had seen every regent in the Amica Federation attend a regency council. Normally, they used the wireless to communicate. They had an encrypted channel over which they could talk to one another. Face-to-face meetings were simply unnecessary, and even then, usually only 5 or 6 bothered to dial in, while the rest ignored the meeting. Yet today, every single one attended, and almost all in person. Once again, Narime glanced at her side. The other champions returned her look of concern. It seemed that no one else had any idea what was going on. Lucia continued to ignore her, however. The Regency Council consisted of the most powerful people in the entire Federation. Each regent governed a province within the Federation, and that province corresponded to the territory they had ruled before their nation had joined the Federation. Ultimately, the Federation itself was a collection of smaller states who had banded together to oppose larger empires and kingdoms. Narime represented her bastion, and therefore the military that defended the Federation. She wasn't here to vote or influence matters, at least not officially. Instead, she was here to offer advice on anything related to war and conflict. The same applied to the other champions present. Bastions could attend in person, but each bastion defended huge tracts of the Federation. They were immensely powerful and important generals. As a champion, Narime was a magical warrior who defended the Federation and represented her bastion politically and militarily. An enormous gap in status stood between Narime and the regents. All of this led to a simple question. If every regent was present, why had none of the bastions been summoned in person, or at least over the wireless? Before Narime's thoughts went any further, one of the regents rose to his feet and started the meeting.
"I'm sure all of you know why we're here today," the regent said, his tone silky smooth. This man was High Lord Tawnius. He was clean-shaven, but his closely cropped hair had long since turned white. Well into his 60s, he was one of the most powerful regents in the Federation. In fact, he was one of the founding regents of the Federation. Despite his words, Narime wished she knew why she was here.
"Because you started a damn war, and now half of us are wondering where we'll find the money to run our provinces,"
Duke Ilmarn shouted and slammed his fist onto the table. The statues of Omria shook. Several fell over, but none smashed, thankfully. Narime and the other champions looked at each other in surprise. None of them had heard that they were at war. Again, Lucia ignored the other champions. That boded poorly. What had happened on the western borders? Lucia was a duo-gem champion of a bastion by the name of Phias. He oversaw the western provinces, which bordered the Yanfeng Empire. The regents grumbled. Many of them glared at Tanius. A few glared at Ilmarn. Ilmarn stood as high on the pecking order as Tanius. Both were founding members of the Federation. Both were wise old men, with considerable influence and wealth within the entire world of Domar. A political duel between the two men was not something to be taken lightly.
"Yes, we are here to discuss the war," Tanius admitted. "Specifically, I have received an update from Emperor Gorthal. I assume that you are all interested."
Narime closed her eyes. Gorthal was the Emperor of the Yanfeng Empire. This confirmed her fears. Somehow, the Federation had entered a war with one of the most powerful nations on Domar. Openly grumbling now, the regents told Tanius to hurry up and stop with the theatrics.
"I will keep it brief, then," Tanius said. "Afterward, all of you will be able to see the correspondence from Emperor Gorthal."
He cleared his throat, then continued.
"Following their unjustified invasion across the Garrick Mountains, the Empire has declared that Bastion Phias has committed heresy. Their demands are that we hand him over to undergo trial within the Empire, and that the war will continue until their demands are met. They have made no efforts to remove the forces they have placed within our territory, and have increased the number of champions located in Fort Tobrum."
Everybody in the room stared at Tanius. Narime had a good idea why. An accusation of heresy was unprecedented. It meant that the Empire was accusing the Federation of going against the will of Omria. Heresy by a bastion was far graver still, as they were servants of Omria and protected nations from demons. If a bastion committed heresy, it raised doubts about their ability to defend Domar. Furthermore, Narime hadn't even heard about this war to begin with, or that the Empire had occupied Federation territory.
"Based on the contents of the correspondence, we believe that Emperor Gorthal has no intentions of returning the territory that they have wrongfully seized from the Federation," Tanius continued. "Between their baseless accusation of heresy and their unjustified aggression, it is my recommendation that we amass an army and—"
"Now hold on a fucking second," Ilmarn interrupted. "I may not have been involved in this nonsense to begin with, but you're missing a few parts, Tanius. Unjustified? You invaded the Empire! You sent an army through Garrick Pass, and now you're screaming about how we should be shocked that the Empire struck back."
He scoffed. "That is the Empire's story, but we did no such thing," Tanius said. He glared at Ilmarn.
"Save your breath," Ilmarn rolled his eyes. "Many of us know that you've been building up an army on their borders all year. I may not trade in weapons, but I can spot food shipments months in advance. You're not as stealthy or as smart as you believe you are, Tanius."
The two regents glared daggers at each other. Eventually, another of the regents waved the conversation on.
"Fine, we're at war with the Empire. Let's move on," Ilmarn said, rolling his eyes.
A few of the regents grimaced, but said nothing.
"The problem is that they're throwing heresy around. The hell are we doing about that?"
"Nothing, I imagine," another regent said. This time, the speaker was Grand Maester Corvel. A balding man in his young 40s, Corvel was extraordinarily wealthy and ran a city-state within the Federation. Narime found it curious that he appeared to be defending Tanius.
Nothing?
Ilmarn asked.
What are we supposed to do?
Corvel asked, looking at the other regents with a sarcastic grin on his face.
Hand over one of our best bastions to the Empire and say, well, you got us, and then move on? What if they keep fighting us? We're at war, Ilmarn.
Don't pretend that's all it means, Ilmarn said. We have defense pacts with our neighbors. Neighbors who aren't honoring those pacts because the Empire says we're harboring heretics.
It's part of their strategy, Corvel said. It demeans them to falsely accuse us of heresy. But we all knew the Empire would use every weapon against us in a war.
The regents grumbled and glared at each other. Almost all of them glared at Corvel and Tanius. Minutes passed, and many objections were raised. They argued and bickered back and forth. Ilmarn leaned back in his chair, his arms crossed. He had remained silent since he last spoke. His eyes set off into the distance. Another regent had also remained silent, and Narime knew this man much better. He was Duke Tereus, a wealthy merchant who ruled a coastal province.
Are we going to debate all day? Tanius asked, his tone exasperated. Or do we plan to make a decision?
Is there any point to a regency council other than to debate over our decision?
Ilmarn asked.
We are all regents here, Tanius. We do not serve you.
There is no need to such pointless anger, Tanius chided. He hid his smirk, his eyes curving in delight at Ilmarn's growing fury.
Ilmarn threw his hands up into the air. And there wouldn't be a need for me to be angry if you hadn't dragged us into this mess. You haven't even described how you stuffed everything up to begin with. Why even invade the Empire?
As I said, Tanius tried to say.
Another regent scoffed.
Do not waste your breath pretending that we did not attack first. Ilmarn is right. We attacked the Empire first. This is the Regency Council, not a public forum. Excuses merely insult us and yourself.
Tanius grimaced, but without missing a beat, he said,
Very well. As I believe all of you are aware, we have been in debate with the Empire regarding the tariffs into their territory for some time.
You must be joking, Ilmarn said. You started a war with one of the most powerful nations in the world over trade taxes?
No, we started a war to ensure future profit for the entire Federation, Tanius said,
anger leaking into his voice for the first time since the meeting started.
If the Empire reinstated tolls at Garrick Pass, many provinces and merchant companies would be unable to meet their anticipated profit goals. Profit that we need to fund our bastions and military.
Wonderful! I'll be sure to tell everybody how easily they'll meet their profit goals now that we're at war with the Empire and nobody can trade with them at all,
Ilmarn said sarcastically.
They can use that profit as a down payment for the armies they'll need to recruit to fight the Empire.
Sarcasm does not become you, Tanius said coldly.
And acting superior doesn't take back the damage that you have done to the Federation with your stupid scheme,
Ilmarn said.
Now,
Corvel raised his hands and leaned into the table. He looked between both regents with an open expression and a gentle smile.
As we argued about earlier, the fact is that we are at war. Shouldn't we be focused on how to deal with that fact?
The regents slowly nodded in agreement, although a couple looked at Ilmarn before they did so. For his part, Ilmarn remained motionless. His eyes flickered between Corvel and Tanius, as if he realized what was going on. Watching from the side, Narime realized that the meeting had slipped beyond any point of argument. Something had shifted in the meeting as the regents began to debate how to amass a military force with which to stop the Empire. The other champions looked at Narime in confusion. No doubt they wondered why none of them were being asked to contribute to the meeting. It was highly unusual for the regents to talk about military matters without involving the bastions or their representatives. Normally, Narime would step in anyway, but when she took a step forward, Deucterius shot her a look and shook his head. She took that as a warning and remained silent. Not all of the regents were trustworthy, but she knew Terius well. Ilmarn continued to ignore the other regents, and a couple of other regents joined him in his silence. Narime saw the growing division within the regency council. At her side, Lucia became calm. Attention had shifted away from the cause of this war, and that meant her bastion had escaped punishment for now. The meeting wrapped up shortly. At no point did the regents ask the champions to provide any information or intelligence. To Narime, this seemed like a gross oversight, or possibly a sign of something more dangerous. Later that night, she traveled to the residence of the regent who warned her during the meeting. It was a small villa that sat atop a man-made hill within the city. A privacy wall built of black granite surrounded the building. Outside, lamps lined the generous walkway of the estate. Each villa occupied a substantial plot of land. Every villa here was worth more money than most merchants handled in their lifetime. Just to enter the street, Narime had to show proof that she had a meeting with someone who lived here. Guards patrolled the streets in pairs and kept an eye out for any criminals. A butler met Narime at the gate of the villa and escorted her to the front entrance. She spotted the runes glowing dully on the ground as she walked. Long familiar with this place, Narime knew that the servants could activate them at any time. They powered defenses hidden within the grounds of the villa. Once inside, Narime was escorted to meet the regent. He sat at a table doing some paperwork. Deucterius didn't look up when they entered and continued to scribble away at the papers. He was noticeably balding, and his figure had long gone past pudgy. The expensive furs that cocooned his body were a reminder that winter had set in. After a few minutes, Terius looked up. He waved for Narime to sit down and handed his paperwork to the butler, who left the room.
"I'd say it's good to see you, but this is not a great time for anyone to see each other," Terius said.
Narime nodded, but remained silent. She watched as a pair of maids entered the room and placed down a tea set. They poured tea for both Terius and Narime, carefully adding tea and sugar as desired by each person, and stood off to the side. Both maids were beastkin. They had horse ears atop their head and long tails full of fine hair behind them. Beastkin came in many varieties, such as horses, cats, and wolves. Deucterius had an entire household full of horse beastkin. His family had long maintained a clan of horses as servants, and his personal preferences were that they served him as maids and butlers. In the Federation, the crucial difference between beastkin and mystic foxes such as Narime was simple. Mystic foxes were considered an independent race with all the rights of humans. Beastkin were not. While slavery was normally illegal, an exception remained in place for beastkin. This was standard across most of Domar, with the Empire being a notable exception that banned beastkin slaves. Terius waved away both beastkin maids, and they left the room. Several moments passed in silence after the door closed.
"I take it you have concerns over today's meeting," Terius said.
"Concerns doesn't begin to cut it," Narime said. "But few of the regents seem to share my worries. Nobody even asks the champions for input on military affairs, even though that's why we're there. Duke Ilmarn was the only one pushing back against Tarnius, and he clearly gave up halfway through."
"Ilmarn has power that few regents have. Most of us need to worry about retaliation if we stand up against Tarnius. Although that's less of a worry now."
Terius took a long drink from his cup of tea and ignored the look of confusion he received from Narime.
Tell me, how much do you know about what's happened so far in the war against the Empire?
Almost nothing. Today was the first I heard of it, Narime said.
But you can hazard a guess, correct?
Tereus said.
We attacked the Empire, lost, and now we're trying to deal with the aftermath. But some elements of that stick out like a sore thumb.
Narime frowned. I assume you are referring to Seraph's absence. Seraph was a duo-gem champion that had been assigned to assist Bastion Fierce in the West. Like Narime, she hailed from the Kurai Peninsula. Unlike Narime, Seraph was human. But a duo-gem champion held immense power, no matter what race they were. And Seraph had been a highly capable champion. On top of that, she had been a highly efficient political operator, and close to Tanius. Her absence had been curious and somewhat alarming.
And what do you think that means?
Tereus asked.
That either she's very busy covering up Fierce's mistakes, or she's dead,
Narime said. The possibility of the latter alarmed Narime greatly.
Close, but not quite.
Tereus drained his cup and poured another. He took his time adding milk and sugar.
She defected to the Empire, along with another champion from the Kurai Peninsula, Sunstorm.
Narime sat in silence for several long seconds, barely able to believe what she had just heard.
Defected?
That's right. We don't know the circumstances, but we know that both Seraph and Sunstorm are now fighting for the Empire. They're under a new bastion that the Empire has just recruited. A Nathan Straub.
Then why wasn't that a major topic of today's council meeting? This is the sort of thing that is of extremely high importance for the Bastions. In the end, we will be the ones to do the actual fighting.
Narime tried to keep the scowl off her face, as she knew that Tereus didn't mean to insult her. Narime had a long history with the Tereus family. If it weren't for this man's grandfather, Narime might not be here. The trading relationship that the Tereus family had built up with the Kurai Peninsula, and specifically with the Mystic Foxes of Narime's tribe, had been crucial to escaping the Kurai Peninsula when demons overran it. So, although Narime had many issues with the Federation, she did her best not to throw them in Tereus's face. She owed him, and the Federation was slowly becoming a home. Not her true home, but a home.
Two reasons, Tereus said. The first is one that I thought you would catch on to right away. Two champions in the Kurai Peninsula have just joined the Empire.
He pointed a fat, stubby finger at Narime.
You are also a champion from the Kurai Peninsula.
Narime stared at Tereus. After a long moment of silence, she spluttered,
Are you joking? The Regency Council believes that I will defect to the Empire with no basis whatsoever?
I wouldn't say no basis.
Tereus raised a hand to stop her from continuing.
Losing two of his favored champions rattled Tanius. Everything he planned fell apart when he attacked the Empire, and he doesn't know why. That's an unusual situation for that old bastard. So he's trying to draw patterns, make connections where they may not be connections. An obvious one is that you, Seraph, and Sunstorm all come from the Kurai Peninsula.
Narime rolled her eyes.
Fine. Let's allow Tanius's delusions and the rest of the Regency Council their unwillingness to challenge him. What is the other reason no one would raise the topic of this new bastion?
Because every time you talk about him, Tanius gets the shits.
Tereus chuckled into his cup.
I thought you were joking earlier, but now you really must be joking.
After several moments,
Narime realized that Tereus was not joking.
By Omria, you aren't. So we can't talk about a major threat to the Federation because Tanius is upset that he lost to him?
More or less. Fortunately, I'm good friends with old George. His spies provided information on this bastion. Apparently, Tanius was the one who ignored Nathan after receiving this information,
Tereus explained. George was another regent, formerly known as King George II. He governed a province in the southwest of the Federation. Evidently, he had been involved in this foolhardy war against the Empire.
And I assume we have no idea why Tanius felt that Nathan Straub was so weak,
Narime said.
Of course not, but we do know that his assessment was horribly wrong. Nathan's defeated the Federation in 3 separate battles, converted 2 of our champions, and captured a large portion of our territory. On top of that, he levied the accusation of heresy against us. As a result, our allies have abandoned us.
Tereus drained his cup again and glared off to the side.
Of course not, Narime said. No nation would accuse another of heresy so lightly, and especially not the Empire, who cling to their status as Omria's chosen country. Corvel is spouting nonsense. Whatever Tanius and Fias did, it was highly questionable.
And that is the problem we find ourselves with.
Tereus sighed.
We know about the Empire. We know about Tanius. And on both fronts, things look questionable. We attacked first, which is the main reason that both of our allies will not intervene. Even if the heresy accusation goes nowhere. The Dark Elves and the Aurelian Spires don't want to give the Empire a reason to invade them, while the Fairies and the Republic of Arcadia are looking for any excuse to weasel out of an agreement.
A difficult situation. The entire reason that the Federation had signed defense pacts with its neighboring nations had been to protect itself against the rising aggression of the Empire. Now Tanius had ruined the best-laid plans to defend the Federation. The Empire had managed to find a way to expand its territory without angering other countries.
How do things look questionable in the Empire?
Narime asked.
Beyond the fact that they're the Empire.
I told you. George gave me his information on this new bastion. Perhaps you know of him from his last name,
Tereus said. Narime blinked, then focused on the name.
It can't be. You mean he's related to Bastian Tarben von Straub? The Crimson Warhound?
Tereus nodded.
I don't know the specifics, but Nathan is Tarben's son, and appears to be as terrifying a bastion as his father is, given his string of victories.
Fantastic! So the Empire has sent an imperialist dog to tear us apart.
Narime shook her head, a grimace spreading across her face.
We don't know if he shares the same political views as his father,
Tereus admitted.
But it's a bad look for the Empire. Our greatest fear has been an invasion led by Tarben's nationalists. Now his son has broken down our door.
Given I'm suspected of being about to betray the Federation, what do we do?
Narime asked.
We still have time.
As if to signify this, Tereus poured 2 more cups of tea.
It's winter, and only an idiot would continue a war in the shadow of the Garrick Mountains at this time of year. Despite Tanius's proclamation, we have time to negotiate. I doubt the Empire wants to fight a 2-front war.
Of course, Narime said. I forgot that the Empire has just started the war again with Trafome to the north.
The pair of them talked long into the night, and Narime gathered what information she could about what happened during the conflict between the Empire and the Federation. She still had large gaps in her knowledge, as Tanius knew little about the battles. Even George had been unwilling to tell his friend much about them. But as Tarius suggested, Narime had time. Time to force her way into any negotiations and establish the truth of any heresy that might or might not have happened. She wasn't about to allow her home to be destroyed. Chapter 4 The weeks rolled on, and winter showed no signs of thawing. This year proved to be a particularly cold winter. Snow piled up on the walls of Garrick Pass, and Faye trained her knights by having them routinely clear out the snowfall that built up overnight in the courtyards. For Nathan, that meant he found few excuses to avoid his paperwork. Now he managed two fortresses and the military of an entire county, Nathan often found his desk inundated with paperwork. His administrator, Kuda, handled a lot of the financial issues, but the military side of things was all on him. The growing tensions between the Empire and the Federation meant that nobody wanted to be responsible for a mistake that allowed an invasion to take place. Technically, Nathan had a subordinate in Fort Tobram who should handle most of this. And she did, but she was also very good at managing upward, which was code for dumping everything that she didn't want to handle on him. So Nathan found himself stuck in his office most days. Sometimes snow drifted past the window, at least on the days that he could see out of it. The rest of the time, he was largely alone from morning to dusk. One of his champions would pay him a visit around lunchtime. If they didn't, usually one of his beastkin knights would steal the opportunity to talk to him. Supposedly, there was a war on. Two, in fact. Nathan felt that the world had frozen in time. It wasn't a new feeling for him. He had seen campaigns and wars grind into nothing due to the frozen chill of the changing seasons. As a bastion, the calm was an illusion. Demons didn't care about the weather, and a glacial January could produce a nation-threatening disaster overnight. A buzzing noise emanated from a corner of the room. Dropping his pen, Nathan rose and wandered over to the strange machine spitting out beeps. It was part of the castle's long-range wireless system, which he had installed recently. He pressed a button on the side, and the beeping transitioned into a low whine. A few moments later, a voice echoed in the room.
"Hate waiting for this thing to connect. I don't even know if it's working," a female voice mumbled. "Kuda used to play with these buttons, but I don't know what they even do."
An unladylike noise came over the wireless, presumably her growling. "Hello, Anna," Nathan said. There was a long pause.
"How long have you been listening?" Anna asked.
"Long enough to know that you probably shouldn't call anybody important using the wireless."
"You're an ass, you know that?"
Anna grumbled inaudibly, the whining of the wireless overwhelming her complaints.
"And are you admitting that you're not important?"
"Given you just returned from the Imperial Diet, I'd say I'm not. I don't run the Empire," Nathan replied, referring to the ruling body of nobles that supposedly governed things.
"Run the Empire? Ha! If the Diet ran the Empire, I'd have been collared as a child and would be working as a maid for Falmir or the Federation," Anna said, her voice pure acid. "Those old buffoons can barely run their own territory."
"I take it your trip to the capital wasn't productive," Nathan said.
"Things happened. Not much, but enough. I don't trust the wireless enough to talk about it over this line, even with encryption. Jump in a carriage and keep me company while I bitch," Anna said.
Nathan chuckled. "Shouldn't you be visiting me? I have the big castle."
"I've been away from home for weeks now.
Anna's tone brooked no compromise. I'm sleeping in my own bed, lounging on my own sofas, drinking my fancy tea, and being served by maids who I don't suspect may stab me if I turn my back on them for too long.
That bad, huh? Nathan asked.
He shook his head. He'd had an inkling that tensions were high in the capital, but this sounded worse than he feared.
Nobody actually tried to kill me, although your father spent more time glaring at me than I think I've collectively been glared at in the rest of my life.
Anna paused, and Nathan suspected she was choosing her words carefully.
He doesn't think much of you, does he?
If he didn't think much of me, he wouldn't be so upset with you, Nathan said. It's more accurate to say that he hates me and everything I stand for.
Fair point. I'll see you tonight.
Anna's tone lifted, and Nathan knew that refusing would hurt her.
I'll summon Seraph and hop in a carriage once she arrives.
Good.
Nathan closed the connection, then opened a new one to Fort Tabram. One of Seraph's aides answered, and he passed on his request for her to join him at Garrick Pass. She could use the gateway between the two fortresses to teleport across.